So I'm going to talk tonight about the aspect which we may refer to as the cause of suffering. And there's a famous quote from the Buddha, if you've been practicing before, I'm sure you've heard this quote before. He says, I teach one thing and one thing only. There is suffering and there is an end to suffering. So this is quite a promise for us when we practice. We realize that there is suffering, but there's also a very clear potential for the end of suffering. And the next quote is actually a description of the end of suffering. To end suffering, one needs to develop a mind that clings to nothing, not holding on, not pushing away, just staying present with what is and noticing the changing nature of all things. One lives in accord with the truth not being anything else than the reality. So really, this quality of present moment awareness is what we're cultivating. And definitely an intensive retreat, there's an intensive way that we cultivate this present moment awareness to actually shift our mode of thinking about things, to actually stay present with what is and notice the changing nature of all things. Right? So this takes time. There's no doubt that you may notice kind of the process, and slowly, slowly, that actually there is, over the days, a shift that is manifesting. And if you haven't noticed it in yourself, there's definitely a way that I can say there is a shift since we've arrived on Saturday evening. There's no doubt that you can sense that there is much more of the power of simply being a little bit connected with the awareness. So by this extraordinary capacity for the mind and the body to connect with each other, be more conscious, more present, we're simply recognizing the nature of things, right? Rather than the interpretation, the idea or the analyzing about what is happening, we're more in tune and have the flavor of the actual experience. This is no small thing. We may not have the actual feeling and felt sense of how meaningful this may be for our own life and understanding of the nature of life. And this is going to be the attempt of the talk tonight in relationship to what this may mean. So what is the suffering when the Buddha speaks about the suffering? There are certain mind states, right? Factors of mind, which every single human being has, which actually are torments. They are called afflictive emotions, right? So they are not inherent to consciousness, meaning that when there's the nature of mind, which is just recognizing experience as experience, there is an unveil, there's a clarity, there's no confusion, there is no torment. This is why actually there is a possibility for the end of suffering. Makes sense. At times, these mind states color consciousness, right? There's a taint. But as anything, they come and they go. They arise and they pass. And this is why there's a capacity for each one of us to recognize them for what they are. And therefore, they don't afflict, right, the mind. In the same way that when we don't recognize them, they have a lot of power. The power that even at times, and a lot of the time, they run the show. Right? And so this is a cause for a lot of pain. Now, there are many of these different mental states or mind states, but there is in the teaching of the Buddha kind of a category. There's many, many lists, you know. And one of these is the three root cause of suffering. And so there are three types. And I'm sure here again, if you've heard these teachings before, you will recognize them. There's greed or craving, lust, any type of sense desire. There is hatred or aversion. That's the second one. And the third is delusion or ignorance. Okay, makes sense? You're following me up to now? Yeah? You're with me? Okay. So these states of mind, when not recognized, they color the nature of mind. And to the point that actually we are being entranced, hypnotized, and they run the show. Okay? But when they're recognized, and this is exactly with present moment awareness, with mindfulness, we begin to have them be part of the understanding, and they're stepping stones to the end of suffering. So this is why nothing needs to be clung to, as he said in the quote, nothing needs to be rejected. The actual recognition has the power, right, to transform what is suffering into the end of suffering. And I'm going to be explaining, of course, a little more what this means. So, it's important to hear that there is no mistake from our part when these difficult mind states are present. There's no deficiency. We don't need to do self-blame or self-judgment or shame. All these added layers, right, are unhelpful. They do come up, right? But they're not helpful. So we really begin to realize that actually to be able to move towards the end of suffering, we will also be in the presence of what we resist. Right? How we resist. And this is what I'm going to be speaking about this evening. So after a few days, we've a little more in contact, and it may be possible that we have a sense that as we're actually being more with the experience and the actual experience, there may be a feeling of greater difficulty. Right? It may be that I'm saying, oh my gosh, at times I feel kind of more in trouble today than when I arrived. There was some freshness, and now I'm all completely entangled, maybe in the state of mind of aversion or anger or lust, right? This is improvement. So it's good news. It's very much good news. Because what happens, and we can't realize this intellectually, because we're not working at the intellectual level. So this is so much out of our reach in terms of reflection. We're really underlying actually the presence and the quality in the felt sense. So it doesn't work in the normal way, habitual way of understanding how we've kind of progressed and the process. We try to evaluate, and it's not helpful because every time we evaluate, we think, oh, it's getting worse and worse and worse. And yet, I'm saying here, we're actually improving. Why? Because instead of being so much at a distance, so far away thinking about, you know, what's not here, we begin to actually maybe have a commentary, have an entanglement with what is here, right? And so we're deeply connecting with our patterns, our conditioning, right? And what is actually the suffering for us. So we allow the process to deepen. And there's no doubt that it cannot deepen without encountering these mind states. Isn't that rejoicing? When I heard that, it was really, whoa, what relief, you know? There's nothing wrong about my way of practicing. So as the Dalai Lama says, nothing, absolutely nothing is not worthy of our attention. Remember that, he says, remember that. Often the difficulties that we encounter are the places that most wake us up. It's impossible to actually live the end of suffering without encountering the actual fact of what causes the suffering. And that's quite fantastic because nothing, no one can do this work for ourselves, and yet when we are really interested, something marvelous can happen. And so even in the hard times, there's a huge ability to disentangle, to free the mind from what hurts. So the first, this greed, the burning desire, it's called thirst, tanha. Tanha is thirst. Now, it's an unquenchable thirst, meaning that when you're thirsty and you're in a desert, and that's kind of what the example says, you're in a desert, and can you just imagine if you're thirsty and you're in a desert, there's strong desire in the mind, isn't there, right? This is exactly the type of craving and maybe lust that is deeply conditioned in our consciousness, okay? So what happens is it operates in a way that we are trying to find the satisfaction to relieve the thirst by looking outwardly at different types of experiences, different objects. It may be this fantastic new car or a house in our living condition, right? And we are kind of in obsessed, addicted mind state to get it. Okay? There's a way that we are naturally engaged in getting it. The satisfaction is here. There is a gratification. There is a sense of, wow, I got it. You know, whatever it is. And how long does it last? Not so long, because the driving force of that thirst is still present. And so this is in contact with people, with material belongings, with mind states, wanting pleasant. It, of course, happens also in relationship to spiritual experiences, right? And so we begin to understand the seductive, and it is very seductive, the seductive aspect of what this promise holds. Unfortunately, because of impermanence, it never really gets the lasting satisfaction that we wish to get. So we're on the run again. And in our meditation, it really is clear, we begin to settle. And then we know, you know, realistically, what happens is we want pleasant mind states. We want pleasant physical sensations. It's exactly the same thing, right? We want pleasant food, which I'm so glad we're getting, actually. It's so great. It's so important in a retreat, I can tell you. I was teaching some time ago. The food was so terrible. No relief here. And how the meal times are so important. What happens is, finally satisfaction. Something pleasant to look forward to. And we know we get it here. This is so great, because we can absolutely appreciate the pleasantness. And isn't there that moment when you end the meal, and I always had this when I was kind of a practitioner, yogi, say, it's ended. And there you are, you know. Okay, what's the next thing? Walking, sitting. It's fascinating how the mind functions, you know. Woo! So there is a driving force. And if we're in a setup like this, a structure like this one, it's actually to be able to serve, to really meet that driving force. That's why we're not entertaining you so much, or not at all. If there would be entertainment, we wouldn't be able to really sense this. Not only think about it, but actually feel it in our belly. Really, this driving force of, wow, I don't know what you thought today about what you're going to be doing at the end of the retreat. What is the thing you're going to be getting or reaching out, you know? For me, it was coffee. Right? I mean, it's so trivial. It's just that cup of coffee, the very first sip, you know? And it's just so amazing because it really begins to be so little. And it's just this driving force of the need. There it is. Unfortunately, I'm not going to ruin your dream land, whatever it is, that moment in reality is never as pleasant as what we have imagined. So this is, we really understand this, and it's great because we actually begin to realize that wanting more, wanting better, wanting to fulfill this inner hunger or thirst is actually painful. It is suffering in itself, right? So we want to repeat the experience, and we want to repeat the experience. It's compulsive desire. And we have that in different domains for each one of us. It's going to be a different domain, for sure. There are many different types. Now, the wanting that comes from this greed, tanha, I have to mention this, is a very different type of wanting or desire than the desire that I talked about and that is spoken about in reflection to aspiration, right? If we didn't have any desire at all, we would fall into depression, right? And many people that do have some moments of depression in life or have chronic depression, there's a lack of desire. And so there is a lack of fuel, of aspiration to wish to accomplish, right? So this is very, very important to hear, right? We're not here talking about what is called, and the name is chanda, the desire to accomplish, the desire for dharma, the desire to actually serve, right? To practice generosity. All of this is totally beneficial, right? So it's a very specific desire. How to recognize tanha, this greed, this compulsive. Because in itself, actually, there is a contraction. When we begin to actually feel the taste, the flavor, it's restless. We're in agitation. We're not in aspiration with the creativity that can come in relationship to what can surface from this creative awareness and creative prospect, right? So it's helpful to make the distinction, right? The Buddha had a very strong desire, chanda, dhamma chanda, to accomplish his path towards liberation, which he did, right? It's a very great inspiration for us, right? But if you read the sutras, there's no doubt there was a lot of determination, right? And alertness, and it's very clear. So, in meditation, what begins to happen, and the calling, is actually, rather than the ignorance and the delusion, to constantly, which is the way we behave, is to constantly search for the object and have monkey mind to find the object that will do it for us. The invitation is to turn the mind, the attention, towards the wanting itself. To really actually feel and experience the wanting mind. That mind which wants. So we look into and we actually feel the seduction, the mode, the greed, that entrancement. And at times this isn't pleasant. But if there's true mindfulness, there's a wonderful way that we can actually see that mindfulness with wisdom being wholesome cuts through. That's seen clearly, and the nature of the mind is not tainted then by this force of greed. It's passing. It's arising and passing, arising and passing. So we may have the wonderful opportunity at times to actually notice the absence of greed, right? To notice the absence. And there are many moments, this is not running the show. And everything is quite settled and actually beneficial, and there's no imbalance. So we understand the process. It will come again, and we actually are cultivating this momentary mindfulness to meet this wonky. When we begin to actually experience this from a place of trust, from a settled mindfulness, we understand that the calling for something else outside of ourself makes us believe, and this is the ignorance piece, that something in me is lacking. So to feel fulfilled or complete, right? To feel at peace, same thing, I need something from the outside. Nothing from the outside is going to satisfy that deep yearning to feel complete. So what is actually happening is that the temporary satisfaction that we think comes from getting the object, some of it, yes, this gratification comes from getting in contact with that object. But it mostly comes, the relief, the peace, comes from what? The absence, the release of the greed, the release of the grasping. And this is why we understand that we don't need to run so much. Because we can see in a very clear moment at times, wow, desire, greed, wow, let me look at this, really be in the presence of this. And you see it arise and pass. And it settled again. And you didn't get the object. You didn't get the thing. You didn't get the whatever it is. And this is why retreat is so great. Because we really allow for the process and over time. And because it's so intensive, this is why we we don't do so many activities to actually deepen the connection, to actually understand that desire, like anything else, a pain in the body, or a thought, a fantastic memory, or an anticipation in relationship to something which is going to happen, desire comes and goes. Craving comes and goes. And this leaves a very, very deep imprint in our consciousness. There's a real shift, actually. So, of course, it's a habit-driven mode, right? Compulsions and this craving, of course, is very rooted, yet it's not lasting. So nothing in us is lacking. The very place to find the freedom is internal. Okay, so this is how we work with this force. Having the willingness at times to look and to meet the wanting itself. Recognize it very directly, and when mindfulness is present, with mindfulness, there is no greed, aversion, or delusion. And that's what's so great, because mindfulness is actually allowing for the freedom. There's no clinging. And so there's peace. And any moment that there's true mindfulness, it's the end of suffering. So great. So you know with what I learned this? With chocolate. Because for a long time, I had my bars of chocolate on retreat. You know, maybe Swiss people are craving chocolate. I know you have your craving, no? Is it, I was told by a Finnish student, how do you call it? Salmiakki? The black licorice? Is that it? Yeah? So if you have it with you on retreat, you know, I learned this with chocolate. It's so interesting because you take a little bit of chocolate for the whole time of the retreat, right? First day, I'm going to eat just a little piece. Whoa. I'm going to be cut really wise, mindful. I wasn't mindful at all, just the craving. You know? You think you're going to eat a piece, and then, okay, no, just one bar. And then, wow, that calling. It's just so amazing, right? After a whole day, the bar of chocolate was gone, right? It's incredible, this driving force of desire. Not one moment was I eating the chocolate mindfully. Unfortunately, I had a lot of shame. I didn't even have the pleasure of eating the chocolate. See? So this is what happens. We are not even there because there's so much blame and judgment about it that there's a lack of appreciation. Right? So, mindfully being present and then just enjoying it and actually noticing that if there is an amount of pleasure, do help yourself for pleasure. It's not about cutting off the pleasure. This is my point here, right? Pleasant experiences happens. We enjoy it. But we know that it manifests and it passes, right? So that craving force is actually quite painful. So when you see it, oh, wanting again, wanting the chocolate. There's no more chocolate, so you just stay with that experience. And it's very clearly for some people, and as you really are more in touch, energetic. It's kind of an energetic pull. Yeah, you really feel kind of the compulsion. So this is the first. So what's helpful? Just the wonderful discovery of staying present. Strengthening the mindfulness, you reduce the amount of the pull or pressure that comes from that type of desire. So what's helpful? How am I relating to this? What is the attitude? They're good questions to ask. What's unhelpful? How can I get rid of the desire? wanting to get rid of it doesn't work. It reinforces it. It reinforces it because you're struggling and you're actually resisting it, trying on one side to not have it, and the pull is actually greater because it's calling. Okay, so just balancing yourself with recognition and strengthening the mindfulness. The second force is exactly the opposite. As I mentioned the other night, you know, there's hatred of aversion. What is this energy? This mind state is the tendency to push away, right? To not want to feel unpleasant experience. So this, of course, it's more obvious than the seduction, right? Because it's not pleasant to feel the aversion, right? There's no doubt that there's pure resistance, so it's painful to feel. And so it's another form of desire. It's the desire to be wanting to be separated from what is unpleasant. It's exactly the same force, except we want to be separated. If only I didn't have that body pain, everything would be perfect today. Right? Well, it's maybe a little bit of delusion, right? So we think that that object, that body pain, or that mind state, or that person, right, is the cause for our suffering. Nothing can be the cause for the suffering except for your own mind giving the power to that object. And that is so fascinating when you begin to see that it's in your mind, in yourself, that there is an aversion, that quality of hatred. The wanting to get rid of manifests in different forms. And the Buddha's teachings is very clear. There's an active form, which is rage, anger, kind of really very active, right? There's fire burning in those states. Okay, irritation, ill will in another person, annoyance. It comes out often with words which are totally inappropriate, right? We vent this anger, and because we feel the frustration, and yet we can't hold it. We don't have enough balance to hold the frustration. So, all out violence. It's really violence. And this, actually, we can see so much of it in the world today, right? So the anger, the ill will, but underneath there is a very clear type of frustration, the stress, right? So there's the active form, which is all manifesting outwardly, and so we want to avoid it, don't want to feel the unpleasantness, venting. Then there's the passive form, which I think here is very helpful to begin to understand. It's all the different layers, and there are many subtle layers, many different forms of anxiety, passive form, little fears, little types of worry, disinterest, indifference is a form of aversion, boredom. So there are many, many different forms. It's fantastic how the Buddha's actually explaining this, where this passing form is actually a withdrawing, right? But when it operates, the second form is paralyzing. We actually freeze. So instead of bullying at the other, we freeze. There's a frozen state, and we can stay in that for quite some time, actually. So these are the different forms. Again, to meet that suffering, that type of manifestation, and begin to look with mindfulness, to be in presence, and allow for those mind states to be known for what they are, rather than avoid, prevent from looking, is so helpful because it's freeing. we can understand the cause of the suffering. And that too arises and passes. Right? So, again, not getting rid, not pushing away, not clinging to the seductive force of greed, not rejecting the aversion, but learning. And this takes, it takes practice. It takes a lot of metta. It takes a lot of allowing. It's a process, right? So we're not trying in this practice to create a certain state. And I'm saying this because I had an encounter today with a person, and there was kind of an interesting exchange. What am I supposed to create? Or where am I, what state is the meditative state? And I say, it's a process. It's a dynamic process. So it's not to reach a certain thing, but it's more actually being in tune and in touch with this dynamic process of arising and passing phenomena. And in best way possible, with mindfulness, there's a release of clinging to the seductive and stopping the rejection, right? The pushing away of the unpleasant. This is exactly what happens. What happens? What's the difference? Less and less resistance. Less and less reactivity. How is it that we get more peace? By reacting less and less. The diminishment of suffering is exactly that. We allow, let be. So there doesn't need to be. How do I let go? You know, people ask, okay, I hear about letting go. How do I let go? You don't need to let go. You just need to let be. And the resistance by itself with mindfulness releases. We can't do the letting go. And this we begin to sense. It's fascinating to notice this, right? And so what happens is that actually instead of having the aversion to the aversion and the loop of getting caught into, I can't stand this. I want out, right? And we add yet another layer of aversion. We allow. It's okay. And we actually feel and experience that it's okay to feel. So what we have been avoiding for so long can actually be met. This is huge. It's such a huge realization, because then we stop the running away from what is. See how meaningful this is? I mean, it's kind of cutting through the stream of conditioning, because we live so much in this realm of conditioning. And the whole practice is this. One moment conditioned by circumstances, one moment really binded, completely taken, caught. But the next moment, with mindfulness, the chain of conditioning, stream of conditioning can be cut. This is called the freedom from suffering, in Buddhist terms. So I'm going to be here reading the sutra, which exemplifies this a little bit. It's called the Arrow Sutra, and in Pali, Salata, if you want to find it when you're back home. When touched with the feeling of pain, the uninstructed worldling, meaning the non-meditator, okay? The uninstructed worldling, I like, sorrows, grieves, laments, beats his breast, becomes distraught, so he feels two pain, physical and mental, just as if they were to shoot a man with an arrow, and right afterward were to shoot him with another one, so that he would feel the pain of two arrows. Now the well-instructed disciple, meditator, when touched with the feeling of pain, does not grieve, lament, beat his breast, or becomes distraught. He feels one pain, just as if they were to shoot a man with an arrow and right afterward did not shoot him with another one, so that he would only feel the pain of one arrow. So this is, doesn't mean, you see, I mean, this is very important, because if we think that practice is going to prevent us from feeling pain, the pain of aging, for example, or sickness, or death, we're wrong. There's no doubt that these are the conditions of our human condition, right? Sometimes we fall sick, so there is pain. But there is a way to relate to it, which is definitely optional. The mental resistance, the mental fighting, the struggle, is optional. So physical pain and mental pain are not the same. And our work with this meditation in Vipassana called Mindfulness and Wisdom is to actually really sense the difference. Not only to think about it, but to experience this. It's so helpful to recognize that these two are distinct. Right? There is pain, and even mental pain. There may be worry, there may be fear. May I recognize the fear? If we add a layer of fear to the fear, the aversion, which I talked about, this is optional. Do you understand this? Yeah? So now, of course, we understand it intellectually. And it's not enough. This is why we're here. And it's so great to be here because we still have some time to actually explore this process. And if it's of interest to us, then it's amazing because immediately with the same experience, we are in peace. So that's the wisdom. We don't need another experience to feel the peace. In that very experience, depending on how we relate, there's an understanding, there's a mindfulness, there's balance, and there's an allowing. Opening, and we don't identify, meaning getting caught in clinging in relationship to what is happening. So what is the second arrow? The added layer of thoughts of aversion and compulsion, craving. Mental reactivity is optional. So there's always a sensory input. There's pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. These are the feeling tones, the flavor that are manifesting with each and every experience. That's how it is. We're sensory beings. We will sense life, right? Sometimes it's pleasant, sometimes it's unpleasant, sometimes wolf, neither. From that input, there's contact, feeling, and craving arises if we're not mindful. Craving to the pleasant, and very clearly, then clinging, attachment, and in the same way, unpleasant, contact, feeling unpleasant, aversion, and suffering. That's the end of that chain of process. And in any moment of mindfulness, that chain of conditioning, break. Freedom is available. So we really are working, actually, on the conditioned reactivity. This is much more juicy than just being present. Right? Because there's a confusion more and more nowadays, you know, okay, we think present, just being mindful. Mindfulness is onward leading. And it's true that nowadays a little bit we think mindfulness is the aim. But mindfulness is not the aim. Wisdom and liberation is the aim. We need mindfulness, but it's not the end of the path, right? So I remember for myself, and I'm just going to say a few more things, so please have a bit of patience. I remember having had some difficulty in being in touch with these difficult mind states. From a place of thinking that I was actually cultivating an attitude of being caught by them, I was actually increasing them, right? As much as it was unlikable, and especially hearing, because I practice a lot in Asia, this whole aspect of ethics, right, and wholesome, and really being on a path where you cultivate really the beautiful and the the wholesome and the beneficial, which is true, kept me from actually stepping into this field, into this domain. There is no liberation if we don't reveal the shadow side. That's at least my understanding. If we make a split between the beautiful and, you know, we go for the wonders and it's great and pure vision and wow, you know, beautifying. There is a need for this, and I talked about it the other evening, right? I mean, cultivating the beauty, going out in nature and rejoicing, and there's metta and really helping ourselves with the beautiful qualities of heart and mind as a process. But we cannot be fully aware and free if we don't actually confront ourselves or face ourselves in certain moments with these difficult mind states. So in meditation, bringing up the unlikable is liberating. We can trust something. What we can trust, and this is why I talked about it a few times, what we can trust is the wholesome intention, the beneficial intention to look into our own minds and hearts, actually to liberate them. Not to increase and to kind of get caught and fuel more hatred or fuel more aversion or be in a state of fear all the time. See, so we stay at a distance to not be in touch. And of course, avoidance of this says, okay, not this, because then, who knows where it's going to go. But if there is this wholesome intention to actually not be frightened and consciously meeting at times when it comes up, it's not that I decide to work on these, right? But when they do come up, we don't shut the door. Because the transformation happens, as I just said, when we're actually looking closely at times to what is painful. So to not be, in a way, deluded by the fact that they're going to be more powerful. Mindfulness and wisdom is your aim. So you strengthen mindfulness and you stay on the side of mindfulness to actually see more and more clearly. And so helpful that when you are overwhelmed or you get caught into whatever pattern, conditioned pattern, you come into presence of what we call the anchor. Right? The area of balance. The anchor is an anchor. I mean, it's a primary field of experience where you can rest and we can stabilize and we can find a way that we rejuvenate the practice. It's a place of rest. This is also why it's important to have one and the same one, because that meeting point is, in a way, a refuge. It's a protection. And we can continue then to skillfully progress on the path. Does that make sense? Yeah? And this is also why we have an attitude of soft-hearted presence. The quality of metta, of kindness, which we cultivate at times, is exactly for that reason. And all these aids are onward leading to the path of least resistance. Resistance fails. It drops. The second arrow. Right? So Charles will be talking tomorrow evening about the third. And the opposite, which is ignorance and delusion. So each of these states, it's not a transcendental practice. There's transmutation. Right? Transformed. Greed transforms into generosity. Instead of that kind of greed, craving for me, right? There's an opening up and transmuted. It naturally brings up more of a sense of generosity. Hatred and aversion transform into what? Loving kindness and compassion. And the third, ignorance or delusion, transforms into wisdom. So, a little bit more accessible are generosity of heart, selfless manifestation, expression, selfless, and the manifestation of loving kindness and compassion. So everything that is manifesting within ourselves, then of course, is expressed in the world. And we slowly have kind of a sense of living a little more from that place of how can I help? What does this situation call for? Rather than the very automatic compulsion of what can I get? What can I get here? Right? It's how can I serve? What is the expression? So it's huge as a difference. It's huge. I mean, there's really a lot to gain in terms of freedom, but not only for ourselves. This freedom is the freedom of, at times, moments of absence of reactivity, and no reactivity is balance, and it's spaciousness, and it's openness of heart. It's openness of mind. Just the other day, I had someone exchanging a point of view about the situation in the world. We had totally different views. With viewpoints, it's fantastic to notice the practice. This person and I had totally opposite views. She was very stuck in her view. And I was looking and I said, you know what? It's just a view. There's friendship between us, isn't there? Are we going to fight because of a point of view which is different? Yeah! And so we did kind of, you know, had a fiery exchange. But then there was enough spaciousness to be able to actually see how the practice was so helpful, because there was enough wisdom in the mind and in the mindfulness where I said, wait a minute, this is not worth fighting for. And a balance of mind was regained. Okay, we can have different views. The world needs that type of practice. Can you imagine how much we get stuck in our own minds, ideas? Not only in relationship to belongings or possessions or wanting, it really clearly is also manifesting in relationship to viewpoints, to world views. So very beneficial. Yeah, so the core, the peace that is happening here is how we move from ignorance into wisdom. Ignorance is the root cause for greed and aversion to manifest. Okay? So Charles will be talking about this. I'm going to be just ending with a little quote from Saint Francis de Sales. He says, "Be patient with everyone, but above all with yourself. I mean, do not be disheartened by your imperfections, but always rise up with fresh courage. I'm glad you make a fresh beginning daily." I hope you do. "There is no better means of attainment to the spiritual life than by continually beginning again and never thinking that we have done enough." How are we to be patient in dealing with our neighbor's faults if we are impatient in dealing with our own? So here, faults is not a good word, right? It's probably torments, okay? So I'm changing this word here. "He who is fretted by his own failings will not correct them. All profitable outcome comes from a calm and peaceful mind." So this is really what we yearn for, calm and peaceful mind. And the way to have the end of suffering is seeing through it. Really seeing clearly what is the cause and what is the relief.